a young intelligence specialist translator, and members of the USA force based in Augusta, Georgia, arrives home after work one day in June of 2017 to find the FBI waiting for her with a search warrant. This is the true story of Reality Lee Winner, a whistleblower whose actions fueled a media storm over apparent Russian interference in the 2016 US general election, the reverberations of which are still being felt today. With dialogue taken verbatim from the transcript of the actual encounter between the 25-year-old woman and two FBI agents who interrogated her, Reality is the debut feature film from screenwriter and playwright Tina Satter. It opens in Irish cinemas this weekend. The film stars Sydney Sweeney, who many of you will know from her work on The White Lotus, Euphoria and The Handmaid's Tale. I'm delighted to be joined on the programme live this evening by Tina Satter. This is an extraordinary story. First of all, Tina, how did you come across, or where did you come across the story of, it's a wonderful name, isn't it? Reality Lee Winner.
So the movie, tracks what happened to Reality on June 3rd, 2017. And that's when she, you know, is arrested ultimately that day and first comes into the U.S. news. But she wasn't even in the United States. The story just wasn't covered very much. So I, of course, the name stuck out and there was like, you know, a mugshot of her that I had seen somewhere, but I didn't really follow the story very much. Really, no one really did. And then 6 months later, a publication in the US, I think New York Magazine had did a longer form story on her with more pictures. And I was just free reading online and came upon that. And something about the pictures really caught me. She was so young and she's in like her Pikachu gear. And I was like, this is the young woman who was the whistleblower. And there was just more details. And the article also had a link to this transcript of the day she was visited by the FBI. And I had never read something like that. So I clicked the link. And as soon as I started reading this scanned PDF of this encounter Reality had at her home in the verbatim language, I just was totally mesmerized by her within that transcript and what had gone down at her house that day. And I just was really kind of obsessed from then on.
And am I right in saying that the dialogue that we hear spoken in the film is precisely the words that are written down in that transcript? Maybe some of them maybe some of them aren't there. You couldn't give us the entire transcript, but it's an edited version of. But you have not added any words into this. All the words are in the transcript.
Yes, not added anything, and no dialogue manipulated to change the story in any way. Like they are saying what they said that day.
And you didn't shift the order of anything, you know, for dramatic purposes.
Didn't shift the order, no. Did have to take in certain sections that are like that were really long. Like there's a section where they talk to her about CrossFit and working out on the front lawn, and it's a kind of a strangely long conversation even in the movie now. That was even longer. So that was a section like trimmed slightly without changing the meaning, but just where it repeated itself so that I could keep sort of the taut shape of the encounter for the movie and the length.
Which tells us a lot, I mean, about this extraordinary transcript that it was almost, in fact, this was a play first. You put it on stage, first of all, but it was almost a play script. It was almost a screenplay without you, before you did anything to it. Certainly in terms of the dialogue, it was all down there.
That's what I thought when I stumbled upon it. I mean, I was like, oh my God, this is a thriller. Like she's going head to head. I'm like scrolling through. I'm like, when do they catch her? Like she keeps talking to them. Oh my gosh, now they're going to talk about cats. Like these really crazy diversions. Like it just felt like it was such incredible material. And then the fact that it was real was like, of course, this incredible frame of it. But yes, to me, it felt very ready made within the transcript itself.
All right. So she is out. The first moment of the film is her arriving home to her house. So let's listen to that opening moment where the agents are talking to her outside her own house and she's meeting them for the first time. Garrick and Taylor are the two agents. Sydney Sweeney is the young woman, Reality, Josh Hamilton and Marshawn Davis playing the two agents, Garrick and Taylor, respectively. Just listen to it first and I'll ask a question about it afterwards.
The is my partner. What partner? Wally Taylor.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
How are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. How's your day today?
That's pretty good. Just got some groceries.
All right.
Let's show you who we are.
Okay, well, the reason we're here today is that we have a search warrant for your house.
Okay.
All right. Do you know what this might be about?
I have no idea.
Okay. This is about possible mishandling of classified information.
Oh my goodness, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly would say, oh my goodness, okay, if you heard two FBI agents saying that to you outside your home. That's Sidney Sweeney, Josh Hamilton and Marchant Davis there as Sidney Sweeney playing the character of Reality in the film Reality, and the FBI agents Garrick and Taylor. I'm speaking with the writer and director of the film, Tina Satter, this evening. At the beginning of that clip that we heard there, Tina, there's the muffled sound, a sound of a muffled recording. Did you get access to the audio of this interview as well, or was it purely the transcript that you had?
I have never heard the audio. I just work from the transcript.
Yeah, so what we heard at the beginning was a mock-up, if you like, of the transcript, because we get certain sections where we're only seeing audio on screen, but that's the actors acting out that particular dialogue.
Yes, exactly. And it was funny hearing on the radio. I'm like, oh my God, it almost sounds really real. like we could be hearing the actual transcript. It was kind of cool. We're at that point where they're following totally. That's the beginning of the transcript. These very banal hellos, but you can, obviously simmering under it is, they are really there to talk to her about something very serious.
Yeah. And I mean, that was one of the things that struck me listening to that clip today. I mean, I was on the edge of my seat the whole time watching the film, but when you hear that opening section, you realise just how tense the situation was. And in some ways, the Sidney Sweeney character, and she's not a character, the person, reality winner, she's quite calm. She's kind of unnervingly calm when the FBI arrive at her garden at the front of her house.
Yeah, Reality has, since told me, and she talked about this with Sydney. They spoke for Sydney's prep on the movie. She really had no idea why they were there at first. It did not occur to her. The piece that would run that used her classified information that she had sent had not yet run. So she was genuinely confused at first, catches on very quickly, obviously, because she's super smart, and then was just really trying to stay really calm with them because it was pretty terrifying. They were armed. They all had concealed weapons, which she could see because you can actually essentially see concealed weapons. And she was really scared her cat was going to get out of the house and that she'd have to make a sudden move. And then, she could get that they were going to shoot her or something. So she really, for a range of reasons, performs and acts a kind of calm poise for so much of it.
But that's interesting that you say that Sidney Sweeney, and indeed you spoke to Reality Winner herself, the real person. What did that add to it, particularly in terms of what was written down on the page is exactly what they say. So if there's a hesitation, we see the hesitation written down. If there's a bad piece of bad grammar or whatever, if a sentence is stated badly, that's what's written down. It is verbatim, exactly what was said. So you didn't change any of that. You keep all of those hesitations in there. Speaking to Reality herself, did that help with getting that, I suppose, no pun intended, the reality of her voice and the reality of the way she spoke?
That is, Sid could speak more to that. Like Sydney was really, spoke to Reality and so took that in at, they would speak and FaceTime and stuff. And then Sydney has talked about watching how Reality moved her mouth and formed words. But in terms of the emotion under, Sydney also might've talked to her about Reality about that. But I always just sort of work with the transcript as my guide. And what I got from reality was much more like detailed stuff. What, you know, once I was turning it into the movie and wanted to understand like how many cars actually pulled up. Like it was very logistical based, like when more FBI agents arrived, how many cars was that? And then she started sharing these great details. Like I didn't know that they'd actually put that yellow tape around the yard, you know, like the crime scene tape. And she told us that the agents were actually wearing these brightly colored golf shirts, some of them, like the support agents. So for my conversations with her, it was this, these great, amazing details that made it even more specific to that day.
So we get the reality of what's happening around the place, the number of agents that arrive, all of that. When do we find out and what they were doing there and why were they there in the first place? Yeah, there was something about a classified document. What exactly were they looking for?
They were looking for, she had released top secret classified information that proved that the Russians had attempted to hack into election software and election communications in a specific part of Florida in the United States. And she had access to that through her security clearance. And that's what she had mailed to The Intercept.
So where we have this kind of half relaxed conversation, as you mentioned, getting the dog out of the house and making sure the cat doesn't escape and all of those kind of very ordinary domestic things. It then moves into the house and it becomes an altogether a much more tense, a tenser situation.
Yeah, because, you know, they ask her first if they asked her in real life that day, they asked, you know, did she want to stay at home or go to the FBI offices that were nearby? She says she wants to stay at home. So then I don't know what they would have preferred, actually, that, you know, it's hard to know that. But then they want to take her to a room that's quiet because they're recording. And so she says there's this room and she basically says she doesn't really want to go into this room and it weirds her out. But they're like, we can go there. So they take her into that back room. They say, is there any furniture? She's like, I'm not big on furniture. So they're in. I mean, it's sort of another kind of surreal but real detail. This like strange room that she doesn't use with no furniture in it. And then they shut the door. So it's like they can record quietly. And then you have these two men with guns strapped to their body talking to this young woman in a closed up room in the back of her house. I mean, it does get you. Yeah, it changes. The energy definitely changes once they have her back there.
Yeah, and I think this second clip that I'm going to play gives a sense of how the stakes have got much higher at this point. Merchant Davis, who plays the agent Taylor, he's left in the room more or less by himself. There's another guy standing at the door and he gives reality just a little bit of advice about what you should and shouldn't do when you're talking to an FBI agent.
Reality. We obviously know a lot more than what we're telling you at this point. And I think you know a lot more than what you're telling us at this point. I don't want you to go down the wrong road. I think you need to stop and think about what you're saying and what you're doing. I think it's an opportunity to maybe tell the truth, because telling a lie to an FBI agent is not gonna be the right thing. Okay, again, we're here voluntarily, you're talking voluntarily. I'm not asking you, forcing you to do anything, but think. That's what I'm asking you to do, is think.
And that's Marshawn Davis as Agent Taylor in Reality, the film that writer and director Tina Satter is speaking to me about this evening. Voluntarily, it's quite a loaded word when you hear it spoken within the dialogue like that, isn't it, Tina?
It totally is. And I mean, it really was, legally, that was what the FBI considers a non-custodial interview, meaning she was technically free to have said, I'm not going to talk to you and leave. But as they do early in the film, they tell her they need her cell phone and her car keys, and her car has been, you know, is now blocked by FBI cars that have moved behind it. So it's, you know, it's a pretty tricky situation in which to have felt autonomy, for sure. So yeah, the voluntary thing is really loaded, as they say that, under the circumstances to which they're speaking to her by then.
You had already performed, or you had written and directed. And when I say written, I'm not being disparaging to say you had taken the verbatim text and put it down as a script. That's what you did. But you did obviously then direct that, both on stage and in the film. You directed the emotional temperature, I suppose, of each of the various scenes and each of the various moments within that. And how did you? I presume there was an attempt in your head to, in your mind, to get close to what you felt that emotional temperature would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I having done stage so many plays, language tells you so much, right? And obviously in screenplays, you go from that too, and that's the code for the actors and the designers, and of course myself as the director. So each, working with these incredible actors I work with on stage, and then these remarkable actors, Sydney, Josh, and Marchant in the film, in both sets of times, the conversations with those actors, we really all felt there were so many clues to the emotional trajectory of those characters, and especially reality within that transcript. And then even for Garrick, who has the most stutters and stuff, there's so many clues for us, to take from that language. And that's really what I leaned into to feel those scenes, and sort of like with my, like, you know, kind of gut instincts on what, and trying to put myself in reality shoes, and then even the agent shoes of like, what did it mean in those sentences, and knowing what it builds to and stuff. It was just sort of that really close dramatic reading of the transcript to draw that out.
How big a change, or how big a shift was it to move the transcript and the presentation of the transcript from a piece of verbatim theatre to a piece of verbatim filmmaking?
It's they're kind of like night and day, the projects, actually, with the exception of like the words and then, the extraordinary reality winner person. The play, the actors, and these were incredible stage actors, incredible actors in general, but would step on stage. It was just on a platform, really no set. There was, incredible lighting, and we had music and stuff, and they just start the conversation, and there was a really specific movement score as they'd move on stage, but it was just really hearing the language. And so the movie, why I was so excited to do the movie is I'd always been really excited by the idea of how intense and vulnerable it was for reality to be questioned in her own home, in her bedroom by these people she doesn't know are coming to her house. So it was like getting to show the details of her world of this particular day in her house, her car, and these amazing close-ups to get a little more of the subjectivity of what it really felt like for her to look at those men, to be seen in her home by them. I mean, they're quite different in that way. The visual landscape of the movie is just a whole different beast than the stage play.
And the other important detail, I think, is obviously parts of the transcript, perhaps not obviously, but there are bits of the transcript that are redacted on the page. And we see sometimes what we see on the screen is the page of the transcript itself, and then suddenly this black line across a bit. And I remember being very frustrated the first time I saw the first piece of redaction. I went, I want to know what that says. Now, we see that sometimes, but you also explain what you do at other times to make a visual representation that isn't just showing us the black line on the, across a printed page. You have other ways of doing that on screen, which I thought were incredibly creative.
Yeah, it's so funny you say that, because that's how redactions on the page were for me. It's like you come to them and you're like, oh my God. And you really feel like the unseen hand of power, right? Like someone's saying you can't read that, and it's really wild. Something has been disappeared. So that's so evocative, like on the transcript. And I was really curious. And then in the edit of like, what could we do that, was so kind of effective as coming to that. And so this idea of disappearing, the speaker from the scene, like literally redacting them out, they are just gone, was what we started experimenting with in the edit. It was really another exciting breakthrough, I think, when we realized that that could kind of hold in those moments, because they happen in very tense moments. So you want to keep the movie like moving forward. But again, suddenly she's gone, like her words were taken away from that transcript because they've been deemed, wrong by someone. So were sort of playing with that metaphor.
The shot on screen is, let's say, of reality's face, and suddenly she just disappears from the shot. The shot doesn't change. It's just without her there. And then she comes back when the piece of redaction is gone. It's incredibly effective, I must say. Final question. Has reality, I don't know if you, would she have had a chance to see the play? Has she seen the play, or has she seen the film yet? Maybe more importantly.
No, Reality did not see the play because when the play was out, she still was and is still not able to leave the Southern District of Texas. She's not allowed to do that or to vote until November 2024. She's not seen the movie because it is too traumatic for her to watch and relive it. She's been incredibly supportive of it. For her, it's very meaningful that people see her in her own voice in this and that people see what these kind of arrests are like, but it's too much for her currently to still watch it. But her mom and sister and other family members and friends that are close to her have watched it, you know, and let her know they think it's a really strong representation of her. And she's receiving so much support from the, it about to premiere. So I think it's, yeah, it's complicated for her, but she's been so supportive of it. She just can't relive it yet and watch it.
Well, it's an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. I would love to have seen the play as well, because that would bring a different type of energy, I'm sure, too. But lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Tina. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
That's Tina Satter there, writer and director of the film Reality, which opens in Irish cinemas this weekend. And we will be reviewing it on Thursday night's Arena. Author of The Crooked Tree, Una Mannion, has just published a new novel. It's called Tell Me What I Am. It's a fictional story of Dina Garvey, who disappeared in 2004 in Philadelphia, leaving behind a daughter and a sister. Dina's daughter, Ruby, moves to Vermont, where she learns how to hunt, when to seed the garden, how to avoid, and all of that to avoid making her father, Lucas, angry. Most importantly, never should she ask a question about her absent mother, Dina. Dina's sister, Nessa, an artist, stays stuck in Philadelphia, getting more and more desperate. She knows the man responsible for her sister's disappearance. She can't prove it. Over 14 years, 400 miles apart, these two women, Ruby and Nessa, slowly begin to unearth the secrets and lies at the heart of their family. This is the bones of this gripping story. Delighted to have author Una Mannion with me in studio this evening. And you had a great moment, actually, I think, just before you come in the door, Una. Tell us about what's in front. There are two versions of the book sitting in front of you right now.
Yeah, just as I came in, Kay Hand was holding a copy, the hardback copy of the Faber edition, which I haven't seen yet. It's my first time to see it, hold it, which is great. I think the cover looks really, really good.
Yeah, because I had been using a PDF copy, as we often do in these situations. I must say, when I saw the cover, I thought, wow, that really brings the book to life. It's a big moment, I'm guessing, for an author to see the reality of the book, which is something you've labored over for probably a number of years.
Yeah, I think for me, first of all, I've been working on the book for about three years, and it's a journey. I think like tomorrow is the launch, and holding the physical copy is pretty amazing. Yeah,
because you have the American version with you, the paperback version of the American, but seeing the hardback and the favorite version obviously was a big thing. Okay, let's get to the heart of this story, which is a woman who has disappeared, and subsequent to that, the man with whom she was involved moves with their daughter, and that leaves the other family members distraught. That's the nub of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the book opens with the disappearance of Dina Garvey. She's a mother. She's a NICU nurse, so she takes care of neonatal infants. She has a history of mental health issues, and she's estranged from her former partner. And they share custody of the child. Well, she has primary custody, and he gets her every other weekend. And she heads off to work. She lives with her sister, and she never arrives. And what happens is the father is automatically granted full custody, and he moves with her to Vermont, 400 miles away, and refuses the family visitation rights, third-party visitation rights, which he's legally entitled to, because the law says children might, you know, that she has abandonment issues. You know, his argument is the mother disappeared, the mother left them. The mother left, abandoned the child. So he cuts off the mother's family completely.
What was the starting point for this story? Because coercive control and a very difficult man, that's really at the nub of the matter here as well. What was the starting point for you?
For me, I was really interested in the idea of the person who disappears. I think it's even just listening to your previous guest talk about that idea of disappearing someone or redacting someone or trying to erase somebody. And I think there's a kind of violence in forgetting. I always remember Milan Kundera's that line about the struggle against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. That, you know, that the cruelest thing is not just to have done physical violence to someone, but to take away the children's memory of their mother. So I think I was really interested in that idea of like the story that never ends is the story of the missing person. But you know, there's an epidemic of missing women in America and other places, and particularly of indigenous and Black women. And this is not that story. And I'm really conscious of that. I didn't really want to focus. I wanted to really think about memory and the importance of that. But for me, all the material that I've read is that missing women are often domestic. The majority there's a history of domestic violence, and so I was kind of interested in what happens and even to this family that loves her, their sister, and supports her. What happens where someone comes into your world and starts to manipulate
the situation. So in this particular case, the person whose memory, I guess, is being manipulated or erased, or where sections of her life are being redacted, is the young girl.
Yeah.
It's Ruby, the daughter, who goes off to Vermont with her father, with the character of Lucas, who kind of a peculiar chap in many ways. He wants to live sustainably. He wants to hunt his own food, he wants to plant his own seeds, he wants to do all of it, which on the surface of things makes him sound like a grand old chap.
I think this is part of men like Lucas, is that there's a charisma and there's something often quite interesting about them or rogue about them, and this real kind of independent living, and his, you know, he's an outdoorsman and he's cynical and iconoclastic, and you know, he's a dissenter, and there's, you know, that can be quite compelling.
Yeah, he has a charisma about
him. He sort of knows his own mind. And so from the moment Dina, who's quite vulnerable, meets him, like, automatically he sees the vulnerability, and she loves that person who knows
everything,
who knows what they know. And
I want you to read a section, and this is with Lucas, who is the father character, and his daughter Ruby. What age is she at this point when they go out turkey hunting?
She's young, so she might be, I think she's probably about 12. But I mean, that's not uncommon, just to say, in the States, for young children to be out with
turkey hunting with dad.
powerful guns.
Yeah,
just to say.
Let's listen.
Okay, just to preface it a little bit, the kind of hunting that they're doing is in late October, early November. So before they hunt, they actually find a flock and they charge the flock to separate the hen from the rest of the flock. Ruby sat at the base of a beach, almost exactly where they scattered the flock. Lucas was just a few yards away. They settled themselves, masks and gloves on, fully camouflaged, guns ready. Lucas nodded and she picked up the box call and ran it, moving the paddle across the wooden container. The hen yelp echoed in the quiet woods. It was the part of hunting that made her slightly sad, how they separated the hens and their young, and then drew them back by the mother's call. They waited. Patience was crucial. You had to be willing to sit for hours. She used the box call again. Nothing. She leaned back against the tree. Then she heard it. A raspy yelp. A hen calling. She replied on the box. Waited. The hen started yelp again. She called back, not too much. Lucas had taught her, don't overdo it. Then the sounds were close. A shot of adrenaline went through her. She steadied the shotgun on her knee, leaned in, watched the bead, listened. There were three rules of turkey hunting. Don't move and don't move and don't move. Turkeys were smart, could see even an eye blink. She sensed them before she saw them, first one, then two jakes, maybe 40 yards away. She held her breath, dared not move. 30 yards, watched the bead, waited. 20 yards. The bead and the head were indistinguishable. She squeezed, felt the kick from the 20-gauge in her chest as the turkey started and slumped. A hit. They waited a moment while the other Jake fled. Lucas called over to her and they stood, bagged the animal and carried its warm, limp body back to the truck.
Nasuna Mannion reading from her book, Tell Me What I Am. I was talking about the tension in the FBI interrogation earlier on. There's real tension in that scene. You know, I suppose that is the nature of the quietness that would be needed for a hunt. This is a thriller. So to what extent are you kind of keeping the energy going? Because we have to find out what happened to this woman. Why did she disappear? All of those things. We don't need to go into the ins and outs of that. But you need that aspect. But you're also dealing with some very serious topics here. What was that balance for you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would see it as literary fiction, but I know it'll be positioned as literary crime, and because it does have a crime element in the sort of thriller kind of pacing.
Yes,
as,
yeah.
You know, Ruby is beginning to discover things about her father and about her past. I was really influenced by The Tempest. So that Tell Me What I Am is a phrase that Miranda in The Tempest says to her father, Prospero. And Prospero has, you know, from when she was three, they've been out on this island, you know, this, we don't know where it was, whether it was in the New World or, you know, somewhere, you know, in off Europe. But he controls her narrative. And I was really interested in that idea that someone's totally in charge of somebody else's history and their story. And so there's this, you know, he's isolated her. But what's happening is that there's little threads coming through. Mm. She has vague memories. And I'm interested in that idea of like, how can memory be held in other ways, by other people, by community, what you can't erase, even how the body holds it. But she receives a package at school when she's in sixth grade. So she's about, I don't know, 11.
Yeah.
And it completely rewrites her reality because she knows there's things that she doesn't know. And she knows categorically that she's being lied to. Yeah. And so what happens is she's sort of questing, I think, and all the time what she doesn't know is that somebody else is questing.
Her aunt is trying to find her as well. The aunt is based in Philadelphia, which is where you were born and grew up,
yes.
But you're now based in Sligo.
Yeah.
Just before we talk about the move to Sligo, how important was it for you to have Philadelphia represented? Was it just to have something to root? I know that place and I can write about it till the cows come home.
I guess because it's in my mind, I draw on Philadelphia all the time, yeah. Or I can walk streets.
You don't
and
have
know
to go and do with, the research.
Without, yeah, but I also had the opportunity to research. So I spent 3 days with the homicide detective, a former homicide detective. I got to go to the criminal court. I was in the Roundhouse, the very famous Roundhouse, which is like a building in Philadelphia. It's like basically the police HQ, and it's allegedly shaped like handcuffs, you know, but really bizarre place. Like they've nothing digitized, like files from the floor to the ceiling. But it was really amazing to spend this time with the homicide detective in a place like Philadelphia. And some of my nieces were like, oh, you know, now you're all about the men in blue or the boys in blue and you've turned, you know. But it was really such an eye-opener to see that experience. And I mean, I haven't written a procedural, but it was important to kind of know
what
happens.
Was, yeah. And when I say it's a thriller, there are certainly thriller aspects to the way the story is told in terms of how it unfolds in front of us. When did the move to Sligo come and why?
Yeah, so I've been in Sligo since 19. I've been coming to Sligo all my life. My father's from Strandhill and comes to Sligo. So I came as a child. And then in the late 80s, I met my husband. He's a traditional musician from Sligo and plays with Dervish, the band. And stayed, and I've been here since.
Yeah, great tunes obviously kept you as well as everything else. You got to listen to Dervish at home.
Yeah,
that was quite handy. But there is certainly something about, and I know that you teach creative writing as well, and in and around the Sligo region, there's something about what's a kind of an artistic movement. I know it has all of that magical landscape around it, but what's going on there? I mean, I think it was Louise Kennedy was the one who told us that it was you who said to her, go to a writer's workshop.
I have to confess, it was actually Niamh McCabe, our friend Niamh McCabe, who brought her to the workshop, and myself and Rose Jordan, who's Kathy Jordan, the singer, Jordan's sister. Rose and I had started the writing group. And on the first night, you know, about 10 of us showed up, and Louise was one of them. And she wrote this amazing story. But I think for all of us, I mean, Louise was already a voracious reader for years, and I've known her for a long time. But there's a whole environment in Sligo that maybe even began, I mean, I don't know about Yeats or, but there's obviously there's this legacy and this respect. But like Dermot Healy was there and doing Force 10. Lillian Bardwell was there. Brian Layden is there. Owen McNamee, Kevin Barry. Molly McCluskey was there. Tess Gallagher spent summers there. You know, I could go. But then there's this new crop of writers. I mean, Sheila Armstrong is from Sligo, and her book has just came out last week. And
yeah, we were speaking about it actually on the program. Yeah,
brilliant writer. And so there is. It's a really supportive and I guess a great place to work and be disciplined because you don't have the distractions of a city. But there does feel like to me personally, I feel like I'm very supported by a community. And on the writing course, which is at Atlantic Technological University, it's like the new ATU Sligo. Because we have a writing course, we have writers like Elska Rahul and Alice Lyons, Jared Byrne, there's Keith Hopper, there's all these people positioned there. So I guess there's a kind of community there as well, and a really great library.
And you say you're drawn back to Philadelphia, and indeed in the novel Tell Me What I Am, there is a chunk in Philadelphia and there's a chunk in the more rural aspect, I suppose, of Vermont, because we get the hunt and we get various other rural aspects in that side of the story. What about the magical landscape of Sligo? Does that seep into the writing, or has that been seeping into the writing in any way?
I don't think I would have ever written if I didn't live in Sligo. Like, I guess that's, I'm just being real about that. And part of that, I think, is just because there's so many people around you writing and there's a respect for writing. But definitely, I think there's something about the landscape for me personally that that's evokes something, or you that you're reaching for something that you can't name, a kind of wonder or mystery, or, you know, and maybe that's what writing or art or whatever is, that sense of mystery. And so, yeah, like I and in this book and the previous book, Ireland creeps in because my experience is being Irish American.
There is an Irish American aspect to the story as well in Tell Me What I Am.
Yeah. My father never became an American citizen. He really was one of those people that never, you know, he divorced after being married for just 10 years and had 8 kids. It was very uncommon, you know, in America at the time. And he had this yearning for here. And I think I probably...
You lived that for him.
I did. And I said I would never live that kind of hyphenated existence. And here I am.
Like, living it.
Yeah. So.
Well, listen, congratulations on the book, and lovely to see you here this evening. I mentioned Louise Kennedy. We're going to play a little bit of Louise Kennedy actually shortly about a new piece that she's done for us here on RTÉ Radio 1. So I'll tell you about that in a while. But first of all, let me thank Aoife Mannion and remind people that Aoife's book, Tell Me What I Am, is published by Faber and Faber. It'll be launched tomorrow evening at Hodges Figgis in Dublin. You'll be there yourself, I'm presuming.
I will be.
Una, for the lodge. That's Aoife Mannion. Now, I mentioned to Aoife Mannion before the break there that we had some Louise Kennedy to be listening to, and indeed that's where I'm going right now. A brand new story, in fact, from Louise. It's the latest writing to have been commissioned by RTÉ's Spoken Stories new fiction project. Information for Birth Mothers, read by Cathy Belton, will be broadcast for the first time this weekend, 7 p.m. on Sunday the 4th of June. In her story, Louise Kennedy plays with the convention of a public information leaflet for a woman in present-day Ireland to tell her story of navigating motherhood at different times in her life. Here is Cathy Belton reading the opening of the section that is titled The Impact of the Loss of Your Baby.
The impact of the loss of your child. The classroom smells of Tato's and periods. The other girls greet you as if you were out sick for a day. They know, you think. The teacher enters and flings all the windows open. She scans the room and finds you, opening her eyes a little wider in acknowledgement. She knows too. For a moment, you are terrified she is going to welcome you back. But she leads the class in a garbled Hail Mary and begins the lesson. The day goes on like that, punctuated by break time and lunchtime and walks from class to class. When the bell rings at 4, you try to get away quickly, but your friend catches up with you on the long avenue. "Why didn't you ring me?" she says. "I was in a caravan for 3 months with her watching me like a hawk." "Was it sore?" "Yeah." "Boy or girl?" "Don't know." "Did they not let you see it?" "No." She wants you to go up the town to brazen it out. "So what if he's there?" she says. But you part from her at the gate. The smell of bleach meets you as you enter the house. In the kitchen, your mother has emptied the larder and is scrubbing a shelf with a nail brush. You are hungry, but she gets cross when you eat. "Get a start on your homework," she says. You open the back door and the cat comes in. You pick her up and carry her to your bedroom, your school bag on your back. You sit on the edge of your bed and hold her over your shoulder, rubbing her back in circles.
And that's Kathy Belton reading an excerpt from Louise Kennedy's new story. The story is called Information for Birth Mothers, and it can be heard in full for the first time, read by Kathy Belton on RTE Radio 1's Spoken Stories, and that will be broadcast at 7 p.m. this Sunday, 4th of June, here on RTE Radio 1. This year's Dublin International Chamber Music Festival kicks off on Wednesday of next week. That's June the 7th. The origins of the festival go back to 1970 and the festival that was called Great Music in Irish Houses. That part of the festival has continued with music being performed in various houses and venues in and surrounding Dublin, including the concert that launches the festival, which it is a concert that will feature five of Ireland's top women pianists. Each of these pianists will perform work by a female composer, but each has also teamed up with two trailblazing women from Irish society to complete the concert programme. To explain more, I'm joined by one of the featured pianists in the concert, Ruth McGinley, who last spoke to us at the launch of the album Aura, featuring the Irish music rearranged by composer Neil Martin. And in fact, Ruth is in a second concert at this year's Dublin International Chamber Music Festival, will perform that album Aura. But first of all, Ruth, good to speak with you this evening. Let's talk about the concert next Wednesday. This is in Windmill Quarter in Dublin 2. Very much a celebration by women of women. Explain the format of the evening, if you would, Ruth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very, very diverse evening, and as you say, it's a celebration of women by women. The idea actually started last year in the 2022 festival, where the same five women pianists, we were asked by Kira Higgins, the artistic director of the festival, to take part in this performance project that reflected on the COVID-19 pandemic. So we were paired with frontline workers who nominated pieces of music that, you know, meant something to them or maybe helped them through that really difficult time. So moving on to 2023, the same five pianists. Obviously, we were a pleasure to work with, to be asked again. And each pianist, we're paired up with two inspirational Irish women. Obviously, there's like so many to choose from. And I'm sure it was very difficult for Kira to get down to 12. But they nominate pieces of music that are meaningful to them, whether it be just, you know, a piece or a song that they love. Some others, you know, there's like a deeper meaning for them, you know, it's to do with their work. And then we, all five pianists, we have an own choice piece of a composition or a song by a female composer. So yeah, it's a big, you know, it's a big female celebration, and you know, there's so much depth to it, and we have a diverse range of music. From, we have a world premiere of a piece by Jane O'Leary, the Irish composer, that'll be played by Therese Fahy. We have Chopin, we have The Carpenters, we have Ennio Morricone, and jazz composer Mary Lou McWilliams, or Mary Lou Williams.
Mary Lou Williams,
so, you know, a little bit of everything, a lot.
A lot in there. I just wondered to what extent the two women that that you are teamed up with, Nolene Blackwell, the CEO of the Rape Crisis Centre, and who is the second person that, you're teamed with?
Dr. Lydia Foy.
Dr. Lydia Foy, yes, sorry. Who's
so
really at the centre
she's
of, she's at the centre of securing transgender rights in Ireland.
That's correct.
What did they bring to you? You know, for a musician, what kind of inspirations did they bring to you, and how did that make you look at the music? Maybe if we talk specifically about Ethel Smith, the composer, which was chosen by Nolene Blackwell, the CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. What did Nolene say to you or bring to you about that composer that made you maybe think differently about her and her music?
Yeah, and again, Nolene, she brought to me an idea. So she says, I'm nominating an idea rather than a particular piece of music that represents her admiration for the pioneers of women's rights from over a century ago right to the present day. You know, she's so passionate about that. So Ethel Smyth.
I was just going to ask you, should I be calling her Smyth instead of Smith? Because it is Y-T-H.
Yeah, absolutely. But who knows? She was born in 1858, which obviously was a time of complete male domination in the classical world. So she wasn't only a fantastic composer, and she is starting to become a little bit more known and played in concerts these days. But she was also a leading figure in the movement for women's suffrage. So she was a suffragette. She, you know, like many of the activists, she ended up imprisoned for 2 months in Holloway Prison, I think for throwing a rock through a window of the Houses of Parliament. So she was a real feisty one.
Yes.
You know, she would do well these days. There's a funny story where I think the conductor, Thomas Beecham, went to visit her in prison, and he found her there conducting singing of her fellow inmates with a toothbrush. So, you know, she wasn't giving up. She was very much dedicated to the you know, and she's very famous for one particular song, The March of the Woman. It actually became the official anthem of the Women's Social and Political Union throughout the world, you know. So I have chosen, so, you know, she didn't say a particular piece, but she wanted something played by Ethel Smyth. Yeah. So I again, it's given me a chance to really look closely at pieces of music and repertoire that I don't know. And, you know, and I'll not tell you the age I am, but there's still so much learning to do, you know. So I've chosen a beautiful nocturne that is composed by Smyth.
Right, well, let's have a listen to it. It's a nocturne. It's called Canon by Inversion, which I guess is a description of the mode of composition here, or what Smyth did in the way she went about forming the piece. Let's have a listen to a little section of it. It's just a little section of the Nocturne Canon by Inversion by Ethel Smyth, and it's the piece that was chosen by Nolene Blackwell for performance by Ruth McGinley as part of this concert that is taking place as part of the Dublin International Chamber Music Festival. And I don't know if it's my ears that are playing tricks on me at this time of a Tuesday evening, but as I listen to that, yes, it is of its era, you know, of that kind of late 19th, early 20th century feel to it, but there are times in there when she has kind of peculiar little harmonic turns. Was she very, I suppose, not avant-garde is maybe not the right word, but how progressive was she as a composer, Smyth?
Yeah, again, in looking at some of her piano works, she has written many piano sonatas, which are a little bit more without what you said. But one of the reasons why I chose the nocturne is because I personally love a little bit of dissonance and stuff. So she does go there. You know, I definitely before her time in that. But, you know, I'm always a big believer that everybody plays or writes music from, you know, from their spirit, from what they are. So, you know,
she
I'm not surprised that she was definitely ahead of her time. Yeah.
And I know that your own choice is a piece by Mary Lou Williams called What's Your Story, Morning Glory, which is a wonderful thing. But you also mentioned to us another performer who's coming to the festival that you're really interested in. This is the cellist Abel Selico. He's an extraordinary performer, this man.
Oh, he's just unbelievable. I mean, if anybody listening, please don't miss this this performance. I think he's on the Friday, the 9th at 7:30 at Dublin Castle. I actually witnessed Abel play before he became a big name, because he has actually genuinely become this big world superstar. He brings something completely different to the table. You know, he did study. He came from South Africa to study at a conservatoire in England. So, you know, he studied as a classical cello player, but actually what he does now, what makes him totally unique, is, you know, he uses his cello often as a percussion instrument, and also his voice. Extraordinary voice. And I mean he sings, but he also uses it as a percussive instrument, and, you know, and there's almost like a melodious yearning and growling, and he's just a true force of nature.
I want to finish up by giving him a little bit of a spin, because people should go and hear him as much as go and hear yourself. And I'll give out full details of your concert afterwards. Once again, thanks for speaking to us this evening, Ruth. I'm sure that has whetted your appetite for Abel Sellico, the cellist. Ruth McGinley suggesting that you might go and see him as part of the Dublin International Chamber Music Festival on Friday the 9th. But the concert that she was telling us about with the four other female pianists alongside her, opening concert of the Dublin International Chamber Music Festival, which begins on Wednesday, June the 7th. And then she will also perform her own album, Aura, the music of Neil Martin's adaptations of Shanlow's songs. That's on Sunday, June the 11th at Castle Townhouse. Full details of everything happening at the festival on DICMF, Dublin International Chamber Music Festival, DICMF.com.